good opportunity for all of us to tell John happy birthday. Even though it was yesterday. We have been in this series all summer looking at the book of Galatians called A New Selfie. And we've talked about the core verse of the series in Galatians chapter 2, verse 20. If you guys will put it up here on the screen, we'll all read it together, okay? It says this: "My old self has been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. So I live in this earthly body by trusting in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me." So the whole idea of the series has been this concept of shelf your old self. That Jesus didn't come to give us a better version or a 10% or 20% or 30% improvement in ourselves, but rather to give us a brand new self. If you were here last Sunday, you know that I wasn't here. Our family wasn't here. We were in Southern Ohio for our family reunion. Big deal in our family this year. I think we probably had about 60 people. Sometimes we have upwards of 100, 110, 120 people. We elect a president and a vice president and a secretary treasurer every year using Robert's Rules of Order at our family reunion. We have a great time, but one of the things we do, we always play a lot of games. And this year, one of the games that we decided on was charades, right? So we're playing charades, and my niece is on my team. She's 18 years old, just graduated high school. She's the brainchild of the family, valedictorian of her class. And so she walks up and gets the clue out of the little box, and she kind of gives it the confident wink nod, right? Like, she looks at all of us like, piece of cake on this one. So she drops it in the done pile, and we hit the clock, right? And, well, I tell you what, let's do. Let's just play a little charades, okay? You guys, I know it's a big room, and some of you are like, I wouldn't dare say a word in this room. I know, but some of you will. All right, so the timer starts, and here's what she gives us. She starts out like this. Okay, now the way that you're all looking at me right now is exactly the way we were looking at her. So she gives us this. So we came up with jazz hands arch walking. That's what we came up with. And all of a sudden she just stops and looks at us with this look of, you know, your mental capacity disgusts me. Like, right? Like, come on. So she does that for the next 30 seconds. We come up with jazz hands arch walking again. That's all we can get. Finally, the timer goes off and she looks at us and she's like, Bigfoot. Exactly our response right there. Like, oh, how did we miss that one? So I was thinking this week, do you ever have moments like that where you think you are communicating very clearly and you clearly are not communicating clearly? That is exactly what was going on in Galatians. Paul had planted this church in Galatia, and he thought he had communicated so clearly about salvation and about the gospel. And come to find out, when Paul leaves, a group of critics called the Judaizers come in behind Paul, and they kind of confuse people. So Paul writes a letter back to these Galatians to bring clarity around not only the gospel, but how the gospel not just doesn't save us, but that the gospel heals us, that we consistently keep coming back to the gospel over and over and over again. And what Paul has gotten real pushy about in the book of Galatians is that moral reformation doesn't cut it. Just changing your behavior on the exterior is not good enough. What he's gotten right up in our grill about really is he wants us to push for gospel transformation. And I want you to see those two things are different. Gospel transformation doesn't equal moral reformation. It's not good enough just to change your behavior, because that won't be sustained over time. Now, Paul has pushed and pushed and pushed that this grace that God has offered us is free. It is free grace, such that your salvation is not based on your works or on your past. Rather, it is based on Jesus' works and on Jesus' past. Now, as soon as you roll that out and you start talking about grace, there's a question that comes up. If you're here today, maybe you're here today, you've been a Christian for a long time. Maybe you're here today and this is the first time you've been to church in a lot of years. Maybe you've never been to church. Maybe today is like day number one and you're just starting to figure this thing out. It doesn't really matter where you're on the spectrum. We all kind of have the same question about grace. The question is, Dean, if it's really that way, if really my relationship with God is based on Jesus' past and not on my past, so it doesn't matter what I do, doesn't that kind of take away the incentive for me to become a better person? In other words, sometimes the way we say it is like this. Dean, if I can do anything I want, if grace means I can do whatever I want, aren't I going to do whatever it is that I want? So does free grace equal, for lack of a better way to say it, slack living? Are some people not going to take advantage of grace to the degree they say, well, it doesn't matter what I do because Jesus has already done it for me? That's the question that Paul is going to tackle in the book of Galatians today. Now, for context sake, we're going to look back at verses 1 through 4 when Cale was here last week with us. These are some of the verses that he touched on. It says, for freedom, Christ has set us free. Stand firm, therefore, and do not submit again to a yoke of slavery. Look, I, Paul, say to you that if you accept circumcision, Christ will be of no advantage to you. I testify again to every man who accepts circumcision that he is obligated to keep the whole law. You are severed from Christ, you who would be justified by the law, and you have fallen away from grace. So Paul, again, sets up these two things, grace and law, and he uses the metaphor of circumcision, which we've talked about before in the book of Galatians, was a sign of the Old Testament covenant that was given to Abraham, right? God said, Abraham, here's the covenant, and the sign of the covenant is this surgical procedure, circumcision. I've been reading through Genesis in my daily kind of quiet time, devotional times, and so I've gotten up through Noah, and I was just reminded about how whenever God, you know, Noah lands, the ark lands there on Mount Ararat, and God gives Noah a covenant sign. He gives him a beautiful rainbow, and then just a couple of chapters later, it comes to Abraham, and God says, Abraham, I want to make a covenant with you like I made a covenant with Noah, and your sign is going to be circumcision. And I imagine Abraham was like, wait a minute, Noah got a rainbow, I get surgery. What did I do wrong, God, right? I don't see the difference. But the purpose of that was God to show the idea is the cutting away of our hearts is being separate and holy unto him. We're to be his. And so now here in Galatians, Paul is saying to those people, hey, listen, Jesus fulfilled all of the ceremonies in the Old Testament. Therefore, you don't have to keep the covenant. But what you do need to keep is the heart of the covenant, which is Jesus. So that's kind of the background. So now look at verse 5. For through the Spirit, by faith, we eagerly ourselves wait for the hope of righteousness. For in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision counts for anything, but only faith working through love. You are running well. Who hindered you from obeying the truth? This persuasion is not from him who calls you. So if the idea is that moral reformation is not good enough, just changing our behavior is not good enough, and we're really out for gospel transformation, it brings us back to that question. Does free grace lead to slack attitudes in our lives? Does free grace lead us to take advantage of the goodness of God? I'll say it to you a different way. One of the pastors that I really respect, I heard him talking about this passage in particular one time, and he said, it was kind of like this. He said, you know, one of my sons worked really, really hard in high school to get into an Ivy League school. And he put all of his time and his attention and all this work, and finally he finds out kind of a little past midway through his senior year that sure enough, he gets in to this Ivy League school. And the next time after that, his grade card, his report card comes out, his mom hands it to me when I come home one day, and all of a sudden his grades have just dropped. And so they sit down for dinner, and he pulls out the report card, and he says, hey, son, I notice your grades are kind of down. Is everything okay? And he says, well, Dad, I'm in. Like, I got in. I've done all this work. Why would I keep on studying so hard, working so hard? I mean, I'm in. And, you know, of course, the dad's like, academic integrity, personal excellence. There's some reasons for you. And basically his son gave him the equivalent of, thank you, Dad, when you're done, could you please pass the ketchup, right? I mean, that's his son's like, hey, I'm already in. Why would I work so hard? And that's kind of the question that Paul's addressing. If you feel like, hey, you're in, if that's what grace means, then aren't we going to take advantage of that? In verse 7, Paul says, listen, you were running so well. What has hindered you? That word hindered is an interesting word. And I'm gonna need some help, some volunteers. And Brian and Heidi Fry have so graciously volunteered. So would you guys come up here? And Mark Fauble's sitting right here. So Mark, why don't you come up here? And the word hindered that Paul uses there in the passage is the word to cut into, right? And it just fits the context of our culture extremely, extremely well, right? There you go. Law versus, I shouldn't say versus, that implies. Gotcha. All right, so Paul says, has the law cut into grace in your life? And where that makes sense, I think, for us is in the context of dancing. So here's what we've done. I've got a little waltz music queued up back there in the back. And so I want you and Heidi here in a couple seconds, just like 5-10 seconds of your best waltz, okay? By the way, I can't believe I'm even using this illustration. At the church that I grew up in, like, we were so conservative, like, dancing was, like, we were against premarital sex because it may lead to dancing. Like, dancing was off limits, right? So, here we go. You guys get ready. Just right here, we got a little space for you. Why don't you give him about 10 seconds and then cut in. Go tap that shirt. Ready? Ready? You guys ready? Ready? Hit it. I'm just thinking my way back through this illustration, and I'm thinking that maybe we should use a different label for you when you're dancing. Maybe something other than grace. I don't know. Maybe when you're doing that. Heidi, you are great. Okay, so what just happened is what happens on dance floors all over. What just happened? Mark, cut in, right? Now, whenever somebody cuts in, how do you feel? As a guy, you kind of frustrated a little bit. I mean, you're enjoying the dance, right? You're not going to let it happen, right? I mean, you feel a little bit like, nah. That's exactly what Paul says has happened to the Galatians. You guys can have a seat, and you can keep the super cool labels. Paul says, hey, you were dancing. You were running so well with grace when I left, and now you've allowed religion to cut in. And religion has taken over your spiritual perspective. And listen, whether you're a Christian or not, we all understand this basic tension in our lives, right? Maybe you're on a trek to solid financial footing. And then all of a sudden, somebody comes along and they've got a get-rich-quick scheme. And they'll tell you, you can make 4 times, 5 times, 6 times the amount of money that you're currently making. And all of a sudden, you leave the path you were on. But why? Because something has cut in. You're on a solid trek in your marriage. Everything seems to be moving along, progressing just well. And all of a sudden, a new employee is hired at the office where you work. And all of a sudden, they kind of turn their attention towards you. And all of a sudden, something has cut in. We all know what this tension is. But spiritually speaking, Paul says the greatest danger that you and I have, or at least these Galatians had, and I think just rolls right on over to us, is that we would walk with Jesus in grace from the point of salvation, but it's somewhere, somehow, some way, either it's because we get involved with a place spiritually and we watch and we imitate Christians who are in front of us and we think that's the way you're supposed to do it, or because we just get kind of tired and maybe a little bit lazy in our spiritual lives. What happens is our lives become dry and mechanical and governed by rules instead of being fueled by grace. And Paul says, and I think this is where he's headed in this text. Listen, we're going to be religious about something, right? You say, oh, I'm not religious. Yes, you are. You are going to be religious about, you're either going to be religious about fitness, or you're going to be religious about food, or you're going to be religious about watching TV or going to the movies, or you're going to be religious about your career or about other people's approval or how you get and gain attention or your look. You're going to be religious about something because you're designed to seek out satisfaction. And Paul says, why not be religious about your personal relationship with God and sensing the grace that only comes from him to the degree that your life is fueled on a daily basis, and not even just a daily basis, but on a moment by moment by moment basis, that you're living a life that is connected to your Heavenly Father no matter where you are or no matter what you're doing. Well, Dean, what is that? Look, how do you do something like that? Where do you start? Let's look back at a couple of the verses that we've already read and just kind of break them down a little bit. Look at verse 5. For through the Spirit, by faith, we ourselves eagerly wait for the hope of righteousness. Paul says that what you and I need is we are desperate for hope. The Greek concept of hope and the North American concept of hope are two totally different things, even though the words are the same, or at least translated the same. In our context, if somebody says something to you, asks you, like, is OSU going to win the national championship this year? And you say, well, I hope so. What you're saying maybe is, wow, there's 122 teams in the FBS, and only one of them is going to win the national championship. And yeah, we're pretty good, but man, the odds are kind of, you know, high, kind of stacked against us. Our idea of hope expresses the idea of uncertainty. What Paul is talking about here is totally different. The Greek concept of hope is bedrock assurance. So when Paul says we eagerly wait and expect for this hope of righteousness, what Paul is saying is that he lives out of a place where he has such assurance of his relationship with God that his circumstances cannot cut in and make his life a mechanical working of grace. See, there's a way that we can say, I live by grace, but we're only going through the motions of religion. And the only reason we say that we live by grace is because we certainly don't want it to depend on us. Why? Because we have no assurance. We have no certainty of our relationship with God. And what Paul is saying is that we eagerly wait for this hope, this bedrock assurance, which, above all things, is what we need to live out this gospel transformation. How does that work? Look back at verse 6. For in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision counts for anything, but only faith working through love. Now, when you talk to people about Christianity in our culture, most people think that Christianity is this move away from secular paganism to this life of moral restraint and doing the right things. It's a move away from this whatever I want kind of attitude over here to I'm going to live inside of these boundaries. And interestingly enough, in the Galatians context, it wasn't all that different. You know, paganism kind of ruled the day in their culture. And basically their attitude was pick a god, put a little idol up on your shelf, make some sacrifices, and do whatever makes you happy. Whatever makes you happy, go do it. But then all of a sudden, these Judaizers come along and they present maybe more of a Jewish paradigm in that, where they said, no, you can't do whatever makes you happy. The answer is moral restraint. And here are the rules. Here are the ways that you are supposed to live. And it's real easy for us to look back at them and say, well, that was a couple of thousand years ago, and we're not like them, and we don't deal with the things that they really dealt with. But our culture is not all that different. What are the two predominant views in our culture today? There's a liberal side of our culture that says what? Do whatever makes you happy. Man, don't get so bound up and all this. Just whatever makes you happy, do it. And then there's a conservative view that says, no. Moral restraint is what we need. Here are the rules. Here's the way people are supposed to live. Here's the way people are supposed to operate. And those are the two predominant views in our culture. What Paul is saying what you really need is not a liberal view or a conservative view. It's neither circumcision nor uncircumcision. Those were the two parties he was dealing with. There was the uncircumcision, the view of paganism, and then there was circumcision, the view of the law. He says, listen, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision counts for anything, but it's faith working through love. In other words, what you really need is the heart of the covenant. What you really need is Jesus, and he will simultaneously make you both more happy and more moral than you could have ever become on your own. Because if all you've got is religion, here's what's going to happen. You're going to be successful at it. Maybe the people who are more disciplined, you're going to be good at it, and you're going to end up with an attitude where you're superior, and you kind of look down your nose at everybody else who's not as good as you, didn't keep the rules as well as you. Or we'll all eventually, no matter how good you are at keeping the rules, we'll all eventually end up on the other end of the spectrum at some point. We're all going to fail. We're all going to mess up. We're not going to be able to keep the rules perfectly. And then you end up in this despair. What do I do with my guilt? What do I do with my shame? Because we've all messed up to the degree, haven't we? Haven't we all? And we've all heard that little voice inside of our head that says, whoa. You call yourself a Christian? You think a real Christian would do what you just did? Do you think a real Christian would say what just came out of your mouth? You think God loves somebody like you? See, we've all heard that little voice. So what happens? What's our reaction to that? Man, if you're living in grace, you run to him and you rely on his past and not your past. But if you're living in religion, what happens? Man, you run to works. And you, all of a sudden, it's like, man, I got to get back to church. I got to get back to my life group. Where can I serve? I want to help people. And you find ministries to go, and you serve, because you're trying to work off your mistakes. And then what happens is that our serving or our helping really becomes self-help, doesn't it? We're not serving out of the grace and the love of God. We're serving to earn ourselves some works, earn ourselves some points. One of the great preachers of over a century ago in England was Charles Spurgeon. He said it this way. He said there was a king, and one day in his court, a gardener came in, and he had a huge carrot. And so the gardener lays the carrot down in front of the king, and he says, King, you've been so good for our country. He said, and I have benefited from that. He said, this is the greatest vegetable that I've ever grown. And he said, when I took it out of the ground, I immediately thought I should bring it to you. And he lays the carrot down in front of the king, and he turns to walk off. And the king stops him, and he says, Mr. Gardener, he says, I'm going to give you another acre of land to plow right up by your garden so that you can become an even greater gardener. And the gardener obviously walked away in gratitude. He came to give, but instead he ended up receiving. Well, there was a nobleman who raised horses that was in the court that day, and he thought to himself, man, if you get an acre of ground for a carrot, what would you get for a horse? So the next day he comes in, he brings in one of his young stallions, and he says, King, you've been so great for our country, and I benefit from that. So I decided to bring you one of the greatest young stallions that I've ever raised. He's the prize of my court. And the king discerned what was going on. And so the king says to a couple of his guards, okay, take the horse off to the stables. Thank you very much. And the king starts to walk away. And the guy's like, wait a minute. Well, that's not what I expected. And the king turns around and he looks at the nobleman and he says, let me explain. The gardener was giving me the carrot. You were giving yourself the horse. And I can't help but wonder if a lot of our serving and a lot of our helping is really not just given to ourselves, trying to pile up religious works in front of God so we can say, look, God, look at what I've done. Now, when I need you, you're going to be there, right? See, what we all need is a vision of Jesus' glory. That ought to be the guiding principle of our lives on a daily basis, that we run to him. Be religious about that. I said last week we had our family reunion, and always before lunchtime, whenever we eat together, we always do a family church service. And so typically, one of the guys from our family will say something. One of the patriarchs in our family maybe would say something. But this year, we decided to do something a little different. This year, we invited my friend Scott Bowling to come and speak to our family. First time we'd ever done this. If you were here back in April, you saw the video of Scott. Scott has Lou Gehrig's disease. He contracted ALS a couple of years ago, and it's having a deteriorating effect on his body physically. And so we invited Scott to come and speak to us. And he talked to us out of John 17, the high priestly prayer of Jesus, the prayer that Jesus prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane the night before he went to the cross. And throughout the message, as he talked, man, he just walked us right through that passage. And he got right down to the end of the verse in John 17 where Jesus says, Father, that they would see my glory. And he said, you know, I've been praying. And all of a sudden, he's not speaking. And for, I don't know, 20 or 30 seconds, it seemed like 10 minutes, he is standing up in front of us, and he is just, his head's down, and he's trying to get his composure. And he's got that thing, you know, with your lip starts to quiver. And finally, after about 30 seconds, he raises up and he looks at us and he says, I've been praying. God, I want to see my grandchildren. Now, Scott's not much older, maybe 8 years older than me. He's got a couple of sons who are in their early 20s. And he knows that there's outside of God's miraculous work in his life, there's a limitation on the number of years that he has according to how ALS progresses in his life. And he says, I've been praying, God, I want to see my grandchildren. Well, at this point, it's a Kleenex convention, right? All of us out there in the audience, I mean, we're like, who's got, you know, tissues? And then he gets choked up. And we're like, okay, well, he's gotten choked up. We'll help him pass the moment. We helped him pass the moment. And then all of a sudden, he puts his head down again, and he really gets choked up. And it must have been 45 seconds to a minute. And he said, but while I'm praying, God, I want to see my grandchildren. He said, Jesus is right beside praying to the Father. And he's saying, God, what Scott really needs is to see my glory. Bring him up here where he can see my glory. And I will tell you, somebody might as well swung a ball bat and hit me right in the heart. Because the reality is, where we live and all the things that we have and all the possessions and all of our time and our calendar, what we really, really, really need is a vision to see the glory of Jesus to the degree that everything else fades away. Would grace like that cause us to live however we want? If you saw that, listen, can I do whatever I want to? Sure. I'm a free agent, right? But I love Angie. And so I want to do the things that make Angie happy. Why? Because my love for Angie and Angie's love for me creates parameters around what I want. Paul says to the Corinthians, for the love of Christ compels me, constrains me. It's the word in the old King James. What does he mean when he says the love of Christ? Is it my love for Christ or is it Christ's love for me? Yes. It's that I love him because he first loved me on the cross, giving his life for me, living the life I couldn't live, dying the death that I couldn't die. And I get a vision of that and of his glory giving everything for me. And what happens? That fuels my life to the degree that it ought to change my want to. I can do whatever I want to. But gospel transformation means that I'm not going to allow religion to cut in on grace in my life. I don't want to live in despair or superiority. I don't want to ever get to the place, and we ought not want to ever get to the place where we say, you know what, we're in. That's good enough. Now, what we need is a vision of the glory of Christ that fuels the grace in our lives to the degree that all we have is hope, bedrock assurance that someday, God will turn us into something beautiful. Let's pray together.